Welcome to the Mind and Quip Theology Podcast, hosted by Miriam Peace and Amy Panton, which come out of the Canadian Journal of Theology, Mental Health, and Disability.
We both live and work on lands that have been homes and remain homes to the Mississaugas of the Credit, the Haudenosaunee, the Huron-Wendat, the Neutral, and the Ojibwe Chippewa peoples and other peoples who have cared for the land.
We are grateful for the opportunity to live and work on this land and are mindful of the need to repair broken covenants.
This podcast is an opportunity to model how faith communities can engage in theological and spiritual conversations around madness and crippedness.
If you need a full transcript, you can find our videos on our YouTube channel.
We want to say before we begin that topics and conversations we are raising throughout our time together are often hard.
They are hard for Mad and Quip people ourselves, and hard for our families and loved ones.
So do what you need to do to take care of yourselves, your bodies, minds, and hearts.
And now, here is our episode.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Alicia, for being with us here today. We really appreciate you taking the time to come and talk with us. And so it is our third podcast that we're recording today. And it has been so much fun meeting with people and talking to them about what's going on in their spaces, what kind of advocacy work they're doing in the disability world, in the MAD world. So for today, we're going to be talking about something that's pretty specific to the University of Toronto. And we hope that it will start to spark some thoughts about how MAD and disabled students are being treated within the university context. So we asked Alicia if she would come and talk to us. She is with Students for Barrier-Free Access at the University of Toronto. And so, Alicia, I'm just going to invite you to introduce yourself. If you wouldn't mind just letting us know your name and your pronouns, your academic and professional location, if that's something you don't mind sharing. And then what is your connection to madness and disability? I'll just pop that into the chat for you.
Sure. Thanks for having me, first of all. I'm excited to be here. My name is Alicia Krishna. I use they, them pronouns. I'm currently first year law student at the faculty here, but I did my cinema undergrad at U of T St. George as well. So I've been here for a very long time. My connection to madness disability, I also identify as disabled and in many ways. So varied, I guess, is what I would say what my connection is.
Okay, yeah, thanks so much for that. And we have a connection because I also went to film school like way back when the dinosaurs were roaming the earth in my undergrad. I went and studied film. So that's awesome. Very cool. Maybe Miriam and I can say a little bit about ourselves just because this is the first time that the three of us have met. So I am a PhD candidate at Emmanuel College, which is a part of the Toronto School of Theology. And my research, my dissertation work is on the intersection between madness and spirituality. I'm especially looking at, I'm reading memoirs of people who have lived experience of self-injury and thinking about what their spirituality is like, their lived spirituality is like. So that's my major project. And I also work as an instructor in the Masters of Pastoral Studies program at Emmanuel College, which is primarily made up of students who want to become registered psychotherapists in Ontario. So it's really fun.
Very cool.
And, I'm really pleased that you see her pronouns. And I'm also a PhD student at Emmanuel College, part of Toronto School of Theology, and a bunch of other acronyms. But I'm looking at the leadership and ministry of disabled clergy, specifically in the United Church of Canada. So that's what I spend my days doing when I'm not doing the journal.
Yeah, and we just launched the journal. We put out our first issue last month. So it's been really fun. A lot of the times I think we felt like we were flying by the seat of our pants a little bit. But yeah, we're just so excited to be able to publish work by students and faculty members and other members of the disability community in Canada, mostly. We also do like publish art and poetry and all kinds of fun stuff like that. And for today, Alicia, we're hoping you could come and talk to us about, like I said in the intro, about a disability justice issue that's happening at the University of Toronto. So let's dive in. So Alicia, could you give us a brief overview of what Students for Barrier-Free Access does for MAD and disabled students at the University of Toronto?
Yeah, so SBA, just for ease, I'm gonna call it that. So SBA is a group that's funded by student levies through the UTSU and the UTGSU on campus here. We advocate for disabled students. We also focus a lot on like skill building for our disabled members and capacity building, community building. We also do a bit of work about like educating the general public, not awareness, education. And we usually work in solidarity with other equity seeking groups on campus because we really realize that like disability justice isn't just one thing. It's also like anti-racism work and anti-transphobia work and that kind of thing.
Awesome. That's so great. And for yourself, what's your role within SBA?
Yeah, so I've actually been on the board for 3 years. Right now I am the co-chair and treasurer, and I also help with staff management at the center.
Okay, and so we talked a little bit about your connection to disability before, but why did you want to get involved with SBA?
You know what? It was actually like pure chance. Like I did not plan it. I knew somebody who was like, hey, you should come and meet this person with me. And I went and met our previous advocacy coordinator in the center. And I was immediately like just drawn to the space. And I don't, almost entirely on impulse, I was like, yeah, this is something I want to be a part of. And then I kind of just found the community and I learned like really amazing things that you really can't get in a classroom. And like, my undergrad education was so augmented by my work with SBA that I just never left. So that's kind of why I was involved and how I ended up here.
Oh, that's great. Sounds like it's a really good fit for you. I love when stuff like that happens in life. That's so cool. So for today, we wanted to pick through the university mandated leave of absence policy. So the acronym is UMLAP, and how do we pronounce it? Is it UMLAP or UMLAP? I wasn't sure.
Yeah, I heard it both ways. I say UMLAP.
UMLAP, okay, all right. So we're going to be talking about UMLAP today, and I wonder if you could just help our listeners to understand what UMLAP is.
Yeah, so it's essentially a policy that is supposed to stand apart from the penal sanctions from the student code of conduct to be used in cases of disability or like where there's a health concern or something medical related. It essentially allows the university to place students on involuntary leave And it applies to two situations. So first, if there's a risk of harm to other students, and that situation is kind of split into two sections where there's a future risk of harm that's likely or an immediate situation. And second, if the student isn't able to fulfill the essential academic requirements of their program. They mention a bunch of times that the second situation is only to be applied after accommodations have been offered. We'll get to that. But it, really what they've been saying is that the purpose of the policy is sort of twofold. It's supposed to allow the university to address like risks of harm to the students and also to give students struggling academically the chance to leave the university without the penal sanction. So they, you can actually take, if you're placed on the mandated leave, you don't get any marks on your transcript. There is also a provision for voluntary leave here, which is important because it's not a departmental policy. So this kind of sits on top of all the departments and governs the entire university. And so because of this policy, you're allowed to take a voluntary leave. However, that is not the focus of this policy. And again, we'll talk about that later. The U of T has said that this is a sort of, so the mandated leave is a sort of last resort. But the problem here and our main issue is that there's very little given in the way of accommodations and like healthcare and that kind of thing. And so the last resort is actually a more prescient danger to students than they may realize. And like I say this because a lot of their marketing for this policy is framed it as a compassionate response, but that actually just means not but like a leave without an academic mark on your like a penal mark on your transcript, not that they're compassionate in any other way. It's purely like an administrative thing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think I can speak as a student who's gone through the process of getting accommodations through disability services, and it's not easy. It's really not easy. I know some of the documentation you sent me just to review for this interview today. One of the concerns that students had raised at a recent town hall, which again, we'll get to later, was that how inaccessible accessibility services is, ironically. And this whole, Miriam and I talk a lot about this concept of coming out CRIP or coming out MAD, and the fact that you have to out yourself, but also like, for me, I just found it was like I had to jump through so many hoops. And even like after I jumped through every hoop, just asking for things, basic stuff, like getting a note taker in class was like, I had asked for like, I don't know, some obscene thing, like nobody wanted to do it and the professors weren't really willing to help. So I can understand frustration that a lot of the students feel because they've been some of my own.
And what's important for like the exercise of accommodations is that the central accommodation system really has no like enforcement power. They can just recommend stuff to professors, but at the end of the day, like academic freedom will win. So things like recording lectures, like the law faculty has a strict policy of not recording, even though it's an accommodation or whatever. So there's a lot.
Wow, yeah.
You might get him, but so if I'm jumping ahead, but can you talk about like why U of T had this policy? Like, what do they gain from this?
Yeah, I mean, I would be speculating here. Because they haven't come out and said these things, but we really can't see any other reason for this, especially given the way that it's written. The situation, the stuff that applies to like risks and like threats of harm to students seems to be more about covering their basis for liability reasons. There seems to be a sense, and this is also speaking to stuff that's been happening in the US too, because there's a lot of schools there with comparable policies. And so there's more like case law, there's more lawsuits in the States where the situations have been more public. And so I'm sort of equating the two. But there's a lack of willingness to sort of question and interrogate their idea of risk and threat. And so like, even if there's like a slightest possibility of something going wrong, they won't like ask very deeply about what they can do to sort of have the student remain in the community, but also like address the problem. In terms of the essential academic requirements, that is actually legal language that comes from the idea of the duty to accommodate. So there's like duty to accommodate, the point of undue hardship, except for like bona fide requirements. And so like essential academic requirements are these limits on the thing, except for the fact that there's no standard for assessing what is an essential academic requirement.
Right. And
one of the huge problems with this policy is that it actually begins at the divisions. And this is something that the admin is really not like taking into account, or admin review team, I should say, because they're saying like the OVPS is fine. That's the government that sits at the top. The OVPS might be okay, but the people assessing what's an essential academic requirement actually start at the divisions. And I get the sense that a lot of the division leaders sort of see any sort of accommodations as like a weakness or inherent like inadequacy of a student, and won't really deeply engage with alternate ways of satisfying the actual thing if they don't have to. And like, there's no requirement for that, and there's no like force for that at the divisional level. Like you can't use, for example, downtown legal services, you can't access their representation until you're appealing to the tribunal. And so, there's a lot of stuff that happens that you're kind of on your own. That's what I would, it's a long answer. I'm sorry, I sort of rambled, but.
It's okay. Yeah. We are the most rambling ramblers you'll ever meet. So don't worry.
It's important.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, for sure. And are there any other Canadian universities that have policies that are similar to this that you know of?
We've just started our research on this. We've been sort of dealing with the very condensed timeline for the town halls and then exams. And so now we're getting back to it. Mm-hmm. But we do know that McMaster, for example, has a policy mm-hmm. of addressing like behavior, that they call it behavior related to a health condition, but it's within their code of conduct. Like not as the MLEP stands, like a separate thing. And so it's unclear like the actual process that McMaster follows, but we're looking into it. As for a policy separate from the code of conduct, Concordia implemented a policy in August of 2020. And it looks very similar to the MLAC with a couple of differences. The other thing is in 2019, McGill was undergoing a policy drafting process, but actually put it on hold due to student criticism. And so, we couldn't find anything more recent. So for all we know, it has actually stopped. We've reached out to the student advocacy groups on these campuses, specifically like the CUPER Concordia and CUPER McGill. And so we hope to like work with them in the future and sort of find out what happened with their campaigns. We are also looking into Brock, Guelph, and York. More research to be done.
Yeah, I guess this is more of like a zooming out kind of question, but why do you think this is happening now? Like, why? I guess my interest in wondering about this is because I think some of my dissertation work thinks about like the history of madness, history of mental illness, and you know, the creation of the DSM and all this stuff. And now we've gotten to the point where so many people are receiving diagnoses. And do you think it has to do with like that kind of upward trajectory of diagnoses becoming more, I don't want to use the word popular, but more like normalized for people? Or do you think it is just university trying to, cover their butt. I don't even know if that's even the right way to put it, but.
Yeah, I mean, I actually don't, I don't know why. I will say that the OMELAP isn't a new thing. So it was briefly mentioned in an ombudsperson's report. I can't tell you the actual year off the top of my head, but several years before the first draft was sort of rumored. I think there was like a 2-year difference. And then the draft was circulated towards the end of 2017 and released publicly at the start of 2018 and then revised and approved, I think in June 2018. So it's not like very, very recent. It's just that this is kind of the second chance to raise feedback and criticism. So we're kind of in part 2 of this.
Well, that's helpful. So I want to ask you a little bit about the Ontario Human Rights Commission. So you talked a little bit about the history of OMELAP, and it turns out that the Ontario Human Rights Commission had urged the university to not approve the policy in 2018. And, you know, after doing a little bit of reading, well, actually, I lie, I have been doing a little bit of reading. When I found out about this in 2018, I was like, I can't believe, I was horrified, number one. So I brought, I wrote it like a report and brought it to our Graduate Student Association at the Toronto School of Theology. And I mean, I think other people cared, but there wasn't really much they could do. So it just kind of got, my report got kind of filed somewhere in some lovely filing cabinet. And then I thought, well, now we have the journal. Let's do something. Let's try to do something else. Let's try to raise some awareness on this again. But anyway, sorry, I digress. So the two things that the three things that the Ontario Human Rights Commission was concerned about in 2018 was that, number one, it was about the policy falls short on its duty to accommodate students with mental health disabilities and also students with addictions. And then the one that really makes me kind of queasy is the policy appears to allow decisions made by university administrators who do not have any specialized training on human rights or risk assessment and does not require the university to seek objective information from an expert about the specific risk posed. Like, for example, they don't have to involve a medical professional. And then also, they were concerned about the university's ability to withdraw care. So we could probably go into this a bit more deeply, but this idea of like, students are basically ripped from their support systems. They might rely on like, you know, their benefits through the university, like I do, in order to access therapy or whatever, and all those things would be taken away, housing, etc. So one of the questions I had for you, which is kind of like an existential question, or just like a why is the world like this kind of question, is like if these concerns were raised, like why the hell would the university still go ahead with this?
Yeah, so I mean, again, I can't really speak to their like deep-seated motives for this policy, like at its root, but I do know that they, before the OHRC's letter and after the OHRC's letter, they added a lot of language that like uses the phrases like duty to accommodate and like the university respects its obligations and that kind of thing. But it's not like, again, at its root, it's kind of like slapping a Band-Aid on like a horrible wound here. And so like there are a couple things here. Like the university, like I was saying, is aware of the identical policies in American schools. And they're also aware of the like harsh criticism that has been raised, and also like the very real harms that have, like, you know, like that these policies have caused students. Secondly, policy is structured so as to place the burden of compliance primarily on the student. So a lot of the language is like, the student will be subjected to a mandated leave if they refuse to comply with accommodations provided. But they never actually ask or require themselves to like interrogate why the student is not complying and whether or not that speaks to sort of failure of understanding on their part. And you know, they're kind of missing the point here, because if they really wanted to give students the option to take a health leave, like they say, that it's a compassionate response, they would have, you know, emphasized the voluntary leave portion and not the mandated one. And also there's some sort of, there's mechanisms in the UMLAT policy that allow, like Clause 76, for example, allows the administrators to convert a voluntary leave into a mandated one, which is scary. And in addition, like voluntary leaves also have reentry conditions, and it's not exactly clear why, like that is, if it is compassionate. And so the release, like the new policy that we're currently under right now, sort of speaks to the OHRC's letters like on the face of the problem, but doesn't actually address like the root understanding that sort of governs throughout, which is that the disabled student like doesn't know what's best for themselves and that the admin knows better. And like what we're saying is that it's inherently at odds with like compassion as it's understood by like regular people. And so to answer your original question, I don't know why they started doing this policy, but they went ahead with it because they feel they've addressed the OHRC's concerns, and we're saying they have not.
Yes, I totally agree that they have not. And one of the things that that SBA has urged people within the community to do is write letters to key administrators at U of T who are sort of in charge of the UMLAP to express concerns about the direct and indirect impact of the policy on the student population. So do you know how the campaign's been going? Have a lot of people been getting on board?
So we're not sure about how many people actually sent our letter, but that has not been our focus for the early part of the campaign. We got a lot of requests from students who actually felt like unsafe going to town halls and didn't have the capacity to sort of write in. The OVPS had this like document submission thing that you could have like written the complaint to, and so they didn't feel safe doing that. And so like we wrote something that they could give in lieu of participating or modify as they saw fit. And so that wasn't a major focus of the early part. But that being said, we've gotten an outpouring of student support from our, like the incredible labor from our membership, just because the idea that students can be placed on a mandated leave is like really striking a nerve with a student body that is just so tired with the like open hostility that we experience from the admin on like a daily basis. And so people are like really fired up. We've also gotten support from other campus groups and significantly external organizations. We've contacted a couple we're in the process of contacting other schools, like I said, other disability organizations and some legal organizations who weren't contacted the first time around. And so we're trying to sort of expand our outreach efforts while also sort of telling everybody that we're back again, doing the same thing here. The admin has told us that they will resume their consultation process in September. And so we've taken the chance, so like our big worry is that we will sort of lose momentum over the summer. And so we're taking the chance to sort of educate students about what the policy is, the legal implications, what their rights are, so that they can participate in the town halls. What's notable is that in every single town hall, every single consultation, every time the admin has interacted with the students, there has been like a demand for some sort of companion guide for the students who don't necessarily have the tools to engage with policy language. And so we're sort of inserting ourselves there and saying like, you know, here's what your rights actually are to sort of prepare for the next round of consultations in the new year.
Wow, it sounds like it would be really helpful and really needed. That's great work you're doing there.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Okay, so I wanted to pivot a little bit and talk about the mandated leave now, like in 2021, because we just sort of did a little bit of looking back on how it's been since 2018. So I was reading, I read the Varsity every week just because, you know, some of the articles are good. And they had recently put out a couple of articles about that, like summarize what's happening with the UMLAP. Okay, so I'm just going to read a quote from the Varsity article right now. So, all right. So they explain that the UMLAP has been invoked a total of 9 times from 2018 to 2020, 8 times in the 2018 to 2019 academic year, and once in 2019 to 2020. 5 of the 9 students have since returned to their studies, including one who returned in the 2020 to 2021 academic year. 6 of these cases were quote unquote urgent situations in which a student's behavior posed a quote unquote significant risk of harm to others. Lead reviewer, Professor Donald Ansley, hopefully I'm saying that right, said that when a situation is designated as quote urgent, it, quote, allows the university to remove the student from campus and protect the university community, unquote. Ansley also noted that in the 2019 to 2020 academic year, division heads requested the vice, it's provost, right? I think I'm saying that right. Yeah. Students to invoke the policy 7 times, though authorization was only granted for 1 case. Data on the number of UMLAP requests from division heads was not tracked in 2018 to 2019. In an email to the Varsity, a U of T spokesperson said that division heads have requested that the UMLAC be invoked 3 times so far in the 2020 to 21 academic year. All 3 requests were granted by the vice provost students. This brings the number of times the UMLAC has been invoked since its approval in June 2018 to a total of 12. So full data for the 2020 to 2021 academic year will not be released until the fall, which would be this fall. 12. So 12 students have been placed on academic leave.
Mm-hmm. I actually, it's come up in our campaign, and as you were reading the quote, it came to mind. There's a lot that goes into these stats, and we've done a lot of thinking about these stats. The urgent situations, I want to say, also allow the OVPS to sort of skip all of the procedural stuff that is required for a situation 1, and actually allows the admin to place a student on leave for 5 days where they review the case. It's not clear what happens in those 5 days, but fine. The other worrying thing that stands out to us from these reports, and these numbers come from the OVPS reports, is the 2019 academic year is a 7-to-1 ratio of division heads asking for this policy to be invoked. And that imbalance sort of indicates like how many times like division heads are sort of doing the wrong thing. They seem to be aligned in the next year, but like, again, it's not indicative of like necessarily that the division heads like sort of understand now, just because we have a small like sample set. It's just the 2019 number just really stood out to me and was very concerning.
Yeah, for sure. I think too, one thing that comes to mind for me is we published a piece in our first issue, which came out last month, about the recent deaths by suicide of students at University of Toronto. For those outside of the U of T community who may not know, there have been quite a few students, sadly, who've died by suicide in the past couple of years on campus. One of the things the writer highlighted was this kind of attitude from the university admin, which is like, it's not our problem. Like, it's not our problem to take care of you and make sure you're doing okay. That's something that, you know, should be done outside of the university. Let me back up a little bit. So we have some structures in place where Miriam and I attend school at Emmanuel College, where we have places where people can go and people that people can talk to when shit's hitting the fan, when things are getting pretty bad. And I just wonder, like, I guess for me, Emmanuel seems to be doing better than some other colleges. I don't know how you, what you think, Mir. We have chaplains who are available and also very caring faculty and instructors. I just wonder about some of these students who really seem to be falling through the cracks. Yeah, I'm not really sure what my question is. Maybe it's just more of a comment. Yeah. Feeling that, like, my heart breaks for those students who are not, there seems to be, like, there's nobody there for them.
Yeah, and I'll say, like, as now I've been an undergrad in the arts and science faculty and also a professional student, the undergrad plate, the faculty is just so big, and you get lost in it, and you're required to do all these procedural things. Like, I've always sort of had an interest in policy and law, but when I entered undergrad, I had no idea what was happening, right? And so, like, I can't imagine for students who don't necessarily have that, like, skill set, just to, like, obviously it's horrible for them to navigate it themselves, but I can't believe that the admin thinks that they can do that, like, that the student can, like, survive in that kind of system. And so even, you know, I disagree with the premise that, you know, the university has no responsibility to its students, but even if we were to accept that, the actual processes that they put in place for these kinds of reviews, just, like, it's completely unfair to students.
Yeah, sorry, Mary, are you gonna say something?
My experience with my schooling has been to work things out with my professor directly. And I can only do that because there's safety there in that relationship. And my classes are like 10 to 30 people. So there's relationship. Yeah, but in classes, undergrad classes of 400 people, that cannot happen. So, just a comment. And advocating as a person in her 30s is different from advocating for yourself at 18, 19, 20 years old. So that's been in my mind as we're talking.
Yeah. And the other thing, we were talking about accommodations and exercising them. Another thing that stands out in the process is that students often have to advocate for themselves to their professors, which, by the way, is actually mentioned as something explicitly not to do in OHRC policy, but it demands a lot of advocacy skills that the university does not sort of train you for.
No, you learn them because you need to learn them, but you also need support in learning them.
Yeah, for sure. Maybe this kind of, I think, segues pretty well into thinking about a undergraduate student who, we're just going to talk about her story. In 2019, she's a second year undergrad student at University of Toronto Mississauga, which is about, you know, I mean, I live right by it. So on a good day, it's maybe like a 20, 25 minute drive outside of Toronto. So she went to UTM Health and Counseling Center, which is like there's a place there where you can see mental health nurses, there's psychiatrists, there's different counselors, you can see doctors and that kind of stuff. And she went there because she was experiencing suicidal ideation. So unfortunately, they told her that the psychiatrist, she couldn't see a psychiatrist for over a month, which is ridiculous. And the mental health nurse wasn't there that day. So she was able to see like just normal nurse. And after they talked, they came up with a safety plan that included staying the night with the friend who had accompanied her to the appointment. And what happened just after the appointment is the campus police came to have a talk with her, quote unquote, which is what it was called, about her prior plan to harm herself, arrested her, literally handcuffed her and took her to Credit Valley Hospital, which is about maybe like a 10 minute drive away. Even though she told them she was 100% willing to go to the hospital, there was no problem. She was like, yep, I'll go. And she experienced 2 panic attacks en route to the hospital and vomited on herself. And apparently the officers were just like totally indifferent to what was going on. And I guess another one of these questions that I have, like, why is the world like this question is this really the best we can do for our students who are experiencing mental distress? And I put after that, insert exasperated emoji, because like I'm just so exasperated going through all this stuff. It just, I don't even know what to say.
Yeah. And sort of, it sort of speaks to like the idea that, you know, the university needs protection from these students and the students right. need protection from themselves, which is something that it's a recurring theme. The other sort of idea that comes up here is the idea that like a student in crisis is violent, capital V, which quote unquote requires response by a police. I don't know if it's because they just call the police because there's no other option or because like of a fear of violence or whatever, but either way, that's clearly not the right response. I'm also not sure that the university really understands the like inherent problem with using police as their first line of contact with the student. They, in any sort of situation of like a security risk, even when it's not like UMLAB related or crisis related, they'll sort of jump to the campus police without first considering alternatives. And so in this particular situation, like police should never have been involved. And they say, we've heard from admin that they are reviewing their handcuffing policy, but we haven't actually heard anything, which is kind of concerning because you think they would have learned their lesson with UMLAB in like consulting with students about this, but you know, yeah.
My question would be like, so if the university does that, then students may not feel safe accessing care at the university, which is accessible care for most people. And so I know there's one patient privacy, there's a cause to say among harm of yourself or harm of others, you can break privacy. But if the nurse had made this security plan with the student and saw that they had a friend to go home with, then a question arises, like, why did that nurse break confidentiality?
Yeah, I mean, you sort of hit on an issue that we're actually reaching out to external legal organizations about, just because a lot of our expertise is in like the equity related reasons, like the right. obvious like human rights kind of thing. We know not much about health law and privacy of information. I can say, I feel, and I'm saying like me, like just a person,
yeah.
Feel as I'm speculating, that the university has a very like laissez-faire view towards privacy and disclosure. We know that in ELMLA procedure, there's sort of one consent given at the beginning, and then it's sort of like the information gets read to like the whole case management team and like all the doctors that are involved, and like we're not exactly sure about the legality of that. The other thing that comes up with the policy is usually for reentry, the university will require their own psych assessment. Still not entirely clear about the sort of line between what's admissible, like what's proper and what's coercive, because you're not allowed to coerce somebody into a psych assessment. And so like information and privacy related concerns are something that we're bringing up for the, I think for the first time, the second time around. And yeah, so like TBD on that point, but it's definitely important to consider.
Yeah, that sounds super important. Super important. Alicia, I added one extra thought to our little Google Doc that I had sent you today when I was just thinking through what we were going to talk about. And one of the things they talk about in narrative therapy is this sort of phrase, the person is not the problem, the problem is the problem. And so it seems to me like the university is seeing the person as the problem here more than the problem. So for me, I was thinking today, the problem sort of seems to me like it's the situation in which the student finds themselves. Like, for example, you know, they're anxious from school pressure, they're away from home, they're isolated, especially during this time of COVID, they can't see their friends and family, blah, blah, blah. Maybe they haven't been receiving the kind of care that they need, whether that's mental health care or whatever. So I wanted to ask you, you know, what do you see as the problem here? And how can we move away from seeing the person as the problem and try to focus on the actual problems?
Yeah. So I'll also say, like, in 2017, 2018, something that SBA did is sort of, that came out of UNLAP was create the communities of care campaign. So we started to host workshops building skills like crisis intervention and stuff in the community, not at the admin level. And I say this because it is very clear from talking to them that they just fundamentally don't understand that every interaction a student has with the admin is inherently like hostile or adversarial. We raised the issue of like lack of legal representation, because to this date, one student has tried to appeal but withdrew their application. And so actually no cases have gone to the stage of the process where DLS will represent a student. They just think that the power imbalance is not there. We were trying to explain this to somebody and like we actually had to like explain it, but it seems so obvious to us. And so from our perspective as students, it's obvious what the problem is. The problem is the problem. But from the university's point of view, it's the student, because like in this quote unquote equal relationship of power and willingness to do stuff, like why isn't the student complying with accommodations, and you know, why aren't they like responding to medical treatment? And so is a lot of the campaign thus far has been trying to get it across to the university that like this is our reality.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering I'm wondering what justice would look like. Can that be rewritten to be more community care focused, and or is it like not flexible?
Yeah.
And should it be abolished?
So the stance SBA has taken in the first go around and now remains the same. We advocate for like a complete revocation of the policy. And the reason we do that is because there never should have been a policy in the first place. Mm-hmm. It's just so clear that the admin just doesn't have I don't know what else to call it. So like the ideological basis for enacting a policy that actually respects a disabled student, nor an adequate like health system, support system. And so like any attempt to impose a compassionate leave is fundamentally flawed. Lost my train of thought. yes, right. Alternatives. That's what I want to say. Sorry. The OHRC actually mentioned our policy in their policy on accessible education for post-secondary students. They cited UFT's own lab as an example of what not to do, which like UFT always loves like press. I don't know if this is good press, but so they sort of cited, and in the actual policy itself, they suggest voluntary leave thing as a part of a proper accommodations regime. So not mandated at all. It's not even in the question here. And so something that the admin keeps bringing up is like, okay, so if you want UNLAP to be revoked, should you go back to the student code of conduct where like things are disciplinary and like there are more than two options? That's what we're kind of saying. Like, the university has a lot of like internal introspective work to do before they even consider like anything like UNLAP. And also we should have a voluntary leave policy because that is something that, you know, students do need. And also the voluntary leave policy should not have any reentry conditions because that also is still retaining power and control and discretion for the LEPS.
Yeah, those are some great ideas. I really hope as we move forward that the university will listen to SBA and to some of the other students who've been bringing their experiences forward and talking about what it's like to be a MAD student. I mean, I think sort of kind of some closing thoughts here. I often think and see in some of my own research that a lot of people who write about MAD topics may not necessarily be MAD themselves. So there's a bit of a disconnect between like lived experience, lived knowledges, and then like the actual book that you're writing. And I wonder.
Same for disabled.
Yeah. So this is one thing that really bugs me. And I see some of the same stuff here. When I was looking over the literature, I was thinking like, you know, if the admin had some of these, I don't know if I want to use the word vulnerabilities, but vulnerabilities themselves, would they be treating people this way? And if their kid had something going on in their lives where they were finding it hard to be at school, would they be treating the students this way? And I just kind of want to put that out into the ether for people to think about. And yeah.
Mm-hmm. Something else that, you know, what you were saying raises for me is the fact that like the student support team under the UNLAP is actually put together before the student actually knows UNLAP is being applied to them. So it's student support team, notification of UNLAP, meeting with support team. And it's just so paternalistic. Like, the students' own medical professionals, like, even if they do have that care, the students' own medical professionals are only, like, added as a secondary measure and, like, considered. And so you can imagine what actually happens when the student wants to advocate for themselves and say, like, I need this thing, or I need this thing. You know, I think the university needs to realize that, like, when a student says they need something, like, that's it. Like, there's no discussion. There's no, like, oh, but can you do this? Like, no negotiation. And they need to realize that the only experts on someone's disability is that person themselves. And that's, like, a fun, like, a lesson they, like, really need to learn before they do anything that they just haven't sort of been accountable to.
Yeah, wow. For sure. Mira, do you have any closing thoughts that you want to add?
I would just add that the journal, like, we're a tiny, tiny journal, but we want to support SBA and continue to have these sorts of conversations. We didn't going to a tier with Amy and I were probably delve into some theological reflection on these had some concern, because it raises so many questions about dignity and worth and advocacy that matters so much. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we definitely appreciate support. And I mean, it's not like you said that you're a tiny journal, like that doesn't mean anything. Like, something that has come up time and time again in other campaigns too, is that admin likes numbers. So the more people that say stuff, you know, but specifically, it's not just because these problems that I've raised today, like, have come up again and again. The admin knows.
Oh, yeah.
There's nothing new we can say except for, and, like, the fact that they're not doing anything just keeps requiring, like, students to disclose, like, really horrible events and stuff. And,
yeah.
But, I mean, your journal could perhaps, and this goes out to anybody who may have, like, a unique experience, like, something you're trying to do right now is add, the voices of non-Canadian students to the conversation, because that hasn't really been a part of anybody's focus. So, like, contributions like that you're seeing are missing from the overall discourse are, like, obviously welcome. And yeah,
interesting. Well, I hope we can stay in contact and have further dialogue about this stuff. And Alicia, I think I might, if you don't mind, I might send you a link to one of the articles or sort of invited commentaries that we just published last month. That, I guess, like, in closing, I just wanted to mention this article because it's written by two of our colleagues who raised the concern about people with disabilities being considered disposable burdens in our society, especially during this time of COVID. And I feel like the UMLAP is reinforcing some of those feelings to me anyway. When I read through this stuff, I was like, oh man, I just, because of my own, I'm a MAD-identified student, a psychiatric system survivor, and it just made me feel like a piece of crap. So anyway, for anyone who wants to sort of, like, think through the whole disposable burden thing and think about that theologically, we can link that wherever we end up posting this podcast. But it's the article in our first issue by Alexa Gilmore and
Elizabeth
Moeller. That's right. Yes. Thanks, Mir. Yeah. Oh, my Alexa is now talking to me because she thought that I was talking to her. So I'll just mute myself for a sec. Oh, no, she's done. Okay. Anyways, Alicia, I just want to invite you to add some of your closing thoughts, if there's anything else you wanted to say as we're wrapping up.
Yeah, I mean, in the context of this immediate like consultation process, they've been asking students what they think about the policy. I think expecting responses about the sort of PR nightmare they're finding themselves in, like students don't want to access mental health supports because they worry that I'm not being applied to them, even though it's supposed to be in the rare case, et cetera. So, like, I want to suggest that a meaningful review would have the university sort of looking inwards and asking themselves, like, the ideological underpinnings influencing their dealings with disabled students, the ways that their ideas have caused and are causing violence to students, and the ways that they repeatedly fail to show up for students, including creating systems of support that people can trust. And also consider alternatives to OMLAP, which, you know, we've been challenged to do, but, you know, I'm throwing it back to them to, like, you know, you're obviously saying there's a lot of like criticism of this policy. So like, have you considered anything else is the question you're asking. Yeah.
Yeah. Good question. Very good question. Well, it sounds like a good note to leave it on. So thank you, Alicia. It's been so great to talk to you.
Yeah, it's been great being here.